Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, November 5th. It's been a week since a petition began circulating to put pressure on state lawmakers to investigate one of their own. We get the latest on how that campaign is going. And it is being called a rally for love. A former Miss Hawaii is calling attention to the detention of her husband, who is from Brazil. We take a closer look at exactly what federal funds have been cut in the climate world affecting Hawaii. And we meet a small Kauai thrush with a rare song on this week's Manu Minute. And a group of local high schoolers make a splash in NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a little more than a week since a petition was circulated to put pressure on state lawmakers to investigate one of their own. It stems from a public corruption case that sent two lawmakers to jail, Senator Kalani English and Representative Ty Cullen. This morning, we talked to the man behind the petition. Ali Silbert is a retired federal public defender who played a key part in a previous public corruption case that sent Honolulu Police Chief Louis Kealoha and his city deputy prosecutor wife, Catherine, to prison. So far, close to 500 people have signed the petition. Silbert hopes to garner thousands before he presents it to state lawmakers next month. Here's Silbert.
In order to make this something that the legislature can't ignore, I would like to get at least 1,000, if not 2,000 or 3,000, because the more signatures we can garner on this petition, the harder it's going to be for the leadership of the legislature to ignore it.
Share with our listeners why you feel compelled to circulate this petition.
We found out through investigation by Civil Beat that in 2022, a legislator took $35,000 in a transaction that was secretly recorded by former Representative Ty Cullen. We don't know if that was legitimate or not, but it certainly raises alarm bells, and it's something that should be looked into to figure out what really happened. And if it did happen, we have a legislator who's possibly still sitting in our House or Senate, who's voting on anti-corruption measures, who is taking part in whether campaign finance reform should go on. We know that in the last couple of sessions, the campaign measures that were submitted by the what I call the Foley Commission have been defeated, and perhaps this legislator was part of that discussion. That needs to be aired. We need to find out what's really going on. So that's why I think it's so important that the legislature look into this. After all, it's one of their own. And if they're not going to look into it, then there's an issue that comes up is this the legislature we want that refuses to look into one of their own? And so that's why this petition is so important.
So it calls into question public trust, and is there self-dealing going on in this process? But talk about the deadline, because there is a statute of limitations. The FBI has been investigating this, but we've got no indictments.
Right. This act allegedly happened in January, February of 2022. So there's a 5-year statute of limitations, which will run out in January, February of 2027. And if we're going to conduct any sort of meaningful investigation into this, it has to begin now. It has to begin this legislative session in January. So that's why I'm pushing the petition now and why I want to submit this petition for the next legislative session, so that it gives our state agencies time to investigate.
And we should point out that the other person that was involved in this was behind bars and has since passed away. And so he's not around. So I don't know how that affects the FBI's case.
My understanding, just from having been a criminal defense lawyer for so long, is what may be happening, at least on the federal side, is there may be proof problems. And even if they have certain evidence, if they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone's guilty, then they're not going to bring charges. And besides the fact that one of the key players in this whole transaction may have passed away, there's another factor. 2 years ago, the United States Supreme Court passed a new law that basically said that the federal bribery statute, they basically gutted it in the sense that they found that if you give a legislator a gratuity as opposed to a bribe, a gratuity is not illegal. For example, if a legislator does something for some friend or a contractor and then receives money, that's a gratuity. And the Supreme Court says that's not illegal under federal law. Only if you can prove by clear and convincing evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that it was a bribe to influence a future act is that a crime. And so I think what's really happening here is there may be proof problems that the federal government has, and they may never charge anything, which is why it's so important for good government and for our accountability and for transparency that we investigate this matter. There is a narrative that people will keep putting out there that the feds are looking into this and therefore we shouldn't interrupt their investigation. You can do two things at the same time. There is nothing that prevents the state authorities from investigating this matter while the federal investigation either is proceeding or is not. My belief is we need to look into this now.
So it just sounds like the bar is much higher, maybe tougher to prove and have an indictment hold up in court. There are some who might say, gosh, where do you begin with something like this if you're not the FBI? How do you see this playing out?
There is one person who knows exactly what happened, and that's former Representative Ty Cullen. Under Hawaii Revised Statute rules that where the legislator has this power to create an investigatory committee, they have subpoena powers and they have contempt powers. So if you subpoenaed Mr. Cullen to appear before the committee, and let's assume he appears and he takes the Fifth Amendment and says, I'm not going to testify, I have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate myself. Number one, he has a problem with that response because he has already been punished in federal court for the crimes he committed. That plea agreement says that he's covered for all acts that he disclosed to the government. So I don't really believe he has a Fifth Amendment right that he can invoke. Now, he could say, I have a Fifth Amendment right, at least as to the state possibly charging me with wrongdoing. Although, again, there might be statute of limitations already in effect for him. But even if that were true, the AG's office can give him immunity. If the legislature really wants to find out what happened and they're serious about it, I think you put Mr. Cullen on the stand, either he testifies or you give him immunity and you force him to testify.
And it's been suggested that maybe perhaps this $35,000 didn't go to one lawmaker, that maybe it was bundled, or talk about that.
We don't know if what occurred actually is in violation of the law. It may not look good. It may have been secretive, but that doesn't mean it's illegal, particularly under the laws as they existed in 2022. For example, bundling is a concept where one person gets legitimate campaign contributions from multiple people. So we know there are limits of $2,000 and $4,000 depending upon who the representative is. And so let's say the $35,000 represented 8 checks or 9 checks from individual people. That's not illegal. And so the person puts it all together and comes to the representative and gives it to them or the senator and says, here, I have $35,000 for you. Technically, that's not illegal. Now, when you bundle money, however, like that in campaign contributions, number one, obviously you're presenting it to the representative saying, I got this for you and I was able to get you $35,000 all at once. So there's this issue is, was that an influence, a corrupting influence? But secondly, even if it's legitimate money, it has to be recorded. It has to be lodged in your campaign finance paperwork that you file. And according to research that's been done so far, it doesn't look like any representative or senator reported $35,000 in campaign contributions in around that time period. So there are many things that could be wrong with what happened there in this transaction, even if it's not technically a bribe, that needs to be looked into.
And I know that Civil Beat has done stories and they were looking at who got a sizable amount. And I know they said that Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke received some donations. And she just said it was a coincidence, the timing of all that.
Yeah, and that may absolutely be true. I mean, one thing we need to be careful is you don't want to smear the reputation of anyone, which is why you want to investigate, which is why you want to impanel a committee to look into it. because we just don't know who it was, and we don't know if it was even illegal. It just is something that we need to look into, because not only do we need to understand what happened, but if something did happen that was wrong, maybe new campaign finance laws do need to be invoked. Maybe we need to make new ethical rules that would prevent this kind of thing from happening. The public has a right to know, and we have a right to know what happens so that we can legislate new laws.
On your petition, you have been very direct, and you have asked for support from Governor Josh Green and from House leadership, Speaker, and Senate President. Have you heard anything back?
This is a very touchy subject. It's going to create waves, obviously, and it's going to create dissension probably among legislators, those who support it and those who are afraid to support it. So far, I'm trying to garner some legislators' support within the House and Senate so that when the petition hits the floor, it's not killed immediately, that people will stand up for it. But right now, everybody's playing it very close to the vest, at least in the legislature. The public and different organizations are coming out in very strong support. But in terms of individual legislators, and you'd have to ask them directly what their position is.
And so what is it that compels you to do this? Because, I mean, your name has been in the headlines with the public corruption cases, specifically with Chief Kealoha and his wife, Catherine. What is it that drives you to step up again?
When you hear and see things like this happening, and after I retired and because of the Kealoha case, I get a lot of information, a lot of people calling me, and I'm more involved in local politics, and I'm more involved just in the issue of corruption in general. And when you see something like this happen in your home state, we're seeing what's happening federally, but when you see it in your home state, it can be addressed. We're small enough, and we have enough organizations here who are concerned about these things that we can make a difference, I believe, in Hawaii to make us a better state and have good government and accountability. We can do it, and we can do it here. And so when you see something like this happen, it has to be addressed. Something has to be done. And quite honestly, if we try to change this and leadership or the legislature won't do it, it gives the voting public more information to be able to cast their ballots in the future. They can look at who stood up for this and who didn't stand up for this, who obstructed this and who didn't. And that alone gives the voters more information where we can vote accordingly and perhaps change the direction of our future.
So you are just trying to make sure that we can see clearly as to what exactly happened, and that will influence people when they go to the ballot box.
I think this petition actually represents the purest form of democracy that we have. It's a direct voice for the public to speak to their legislators and say, this is what we're interested in, this is what we want done, where do you stand? Because based upon this petition and how it plays out in the legislature, you can lobby your individual legislator. You can see how they vote and how they act. And it's that kind of information that the voters need to go forward in the next round of elections. If you believe in good government, vote for this petition. If you believe in accountability, sign this petition. If you have an issue with possibly a legislator who might be corrupt, continuing to serve and voting on these very important issues, sign this petition. So I just want to make a pitch that people should look at this petition, hopefully sign it, not be afraid to sign it. And a lot of people are standing on the sideline, afraid to sign it, or waiting for the wind, which way the wind blows. I think this is gaining momentum. I think it's being taken seriously.
We have been hearing from Ali Silbert, who has started circulating a petition to pressure lawmakers to help clear the air about allegations that one of their own may have been involved in an FBI bribery probe. Check for links on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
From start to finish, a downhill ski race is all adrenaline and speed. And also danger. For elite skiers, a serious crash can end a career or worse. I'm Marco Werman. There are new safety measures in effect to help protect skiers. That plus the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union, featuring home equity lines of credit. More about HELOC at hawaiistatefcu.com, federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
It's being called a rally for love. This afternoon at 12:30, supporters of former Miss Hawaii Cheryl Bartlett and her husband of 16 years will gather in front of the federal building in Honolulu. Rogerio Araujo sits in the federal detention center. He was detained by ICE agents about a week ago. While Bartlett has been able to talk to him, she's not been able to see him and is working with an immigration attorney to prevent him from being deported to Brazil. Bartlett and her husband have been featured as musical guests over the years here on The Conversation and on the PR show The Brazilian Experience. Bartlett is hoping to draw attention to her husband's plight at today's rally.
You know, it's a peaceful rally. We're going to be there to show love for Rogerio and others like Rogerio who are in this circumstance. We're going to be there to just raise awareness about what's happening to our neighbors and friends and families in Hawaii and across the United States of America. And we're going to advocate from this platform for humanitarian acts of compassion to keep our families together, and also for immigration reform, which is sadly needed, badly needed.
Well, explain to our listeners the snafu, because you have been married for a long time, and people might think, oh, that process would be expedited as far as, you know, him being a U.S. citizen.
It used to be true that if an immigrant married a U.S. citizen, that would guarantee their status in the U.S. That has not been true for many years now. And I think there's still a misperception, wide misperception, that if someone marries a U.S. citizen, they're okay in the U.S. That is not the case anymore. The cases are very procedural. You have to follow all of the procedures. You have to meet all of the expectations of the current immigration law. And there are glitches that can happen along the way that are hard to overcome. I'm characterizing our glitches as clerical errors. That is how I am perceiving it. Others may not, but my husband is my husband, whom I love, who takes care of me. He is not a criminal. He is not a so-called, quote-unquote, violent criminal to be removed from our country. My husband is a loving husband. He contributes to our community every day, every week. He has contributed to our community here in Hawaii for many, many years. And he's contributed to the life of my family and his family. He has a mother who is a U.S. citizen living in Hawaii and a niece, a U.S. citizen living in Hawaii. He has my parents, my mom, my dad, who is a U.S. veteran with PTSD from the Vietnam War. He lifts all of these people up. He is there. He is their rock. He is my rock. He has been my rock. And I find it inhumane that the current policies dictate that they should take people like my husband and target them for removal, even though I have pleaded for grace in the past and received it from immigration courts based on our individual situation. And now, because we're under the current administration with their agenda, my husband has been targeted, along with many, many others in his situation who have previously received grace. I understand. I'm intelligent enough to understand. I am grief-stricken. I am wretched. And it's very hard for me to stay grounded right now because it's so painful. And I want to speak well, But mostly I want people to know that this ripping, this shattering, this shearing of a family's fabric is inhumane. And we need to make it stop. This is not correct. We have to make it better. We have to use our voices. We have to make it better.
What are you hearing from your attorney? I mean, is there any hope that there will be a hearing so you'd have some due process and you can lay out the facts and argue your case?
She is doing everything she can. And if there is such an option, we're pursuing it. I hesitate to talk too much about what's happening right now for fear of the last thing I want to do is hurt my husband's chances of being with me here in Hawaii, remaining with me in our community, with my family. That's what I want. I want grace for my husband, if it's at all possible. He has a good attorney. She's doing everything she can towards that goal. And I personally think we have a very good reason for him to stay, not the least of which is that I have a permanent disability. I'm legally blind. I have type 1 diabetes since 6 years old. I try my best to manage it, but he's there for me. If I become unconscious, he's there for me. I also have chronic kidney disease due to the length of time I've lived with type 1 diabetes. I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I'm stating facts. He accepts me wholly as a whole being. Who I am, it's part of who I am, and he doesn't complain. He accepts me for who I am and takes care of me. And I do the same for him because we are married to each other, heart, soul, mind, body, spiritually.
Is your husband aware that you are holding this rally today?
No, I wasn't sure if it was a safe thing to share. I hope people understand when I say that. I think some of the inmates have access to the news, maybe. I hope if they see it, they'll share the love with him. And I hope they also know that I'm lifting them up in my prayers and with my love. I don't have hate in this life. I don't have anger. I want to act from love. I want others to act with love. This is the opposite of love. And I can only say it that way. This is causing so much pain for people who establish their lives with their partners. They tried their best to do the right thing. And we are being categorically denied our right to pursuit of happiness in our sense of place in this state and this country. Everybody who knows Rogério knows that he is someone who only wanted to contribute good things to our country, and he has. He's had a long time to demonstrate that. I just need people to know, you know, how much this hurts, how much it hurts our families and our community. Let's try harder to keep our families and our communities strong. Families keep our communities strong. We should endorse humanity. We should endorse a very big concept of love. What is happening to my husband is not of love. It is of anger. It is of fear. It is possibly of hate. I must come from love.
That was former Miss Hawaii Cheryl Bartlett talking to us about a rally being held from 12:30 to 2 p.m. today at the Federal Building. Bartlett and her husband, Rogério, joined us in studio here at HPR back in 2014. They performed together, and we'll let them play us out.
Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from your guitar, floating on the silence that surrounds us. Quiet thoughts, quiet dreams, quiet walks by quiet streams, and a window looking.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Lyrically Rebellious, the Prince of Onchi Koshido, a pioneer of abstract art in Japan. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Join Hawaii Public Radio on Wednesday, November 12th at Consolidated Ward Theaters for the 2025 Ohina Short Film Showcase, featuring the premiere of local short film, The Arrangements, and a live performance by the Hawaii Youth Symphony. Enjoy a night of creativity and connection through music and film, capped off with a post-film Q&A moderated by HPR's own Cassie Ordonio. Tickets at hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from Manoa Valley Theater. The musical Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, tells of a performing trio who take their show to the Australian outback searching for love. Opens November 13th, manoavalleytheater.com.
Funding climate projects has become more difficult under the Trump administration. In Hawaii, several awards have been frozen or cut entirely. HPR Savannah Harriman-Poet has been following this issue closely, and she joins us this morning. Hi, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I understand that you were tracking a meeting that was held earlier this week.
Yes, so there was a hearing before state lawmakers on Monday. It was held by Senator Carl Rhodes and Senator Mike Gabbard, who are the respective heads of the Judiciary Committee and the Agricultural and Environment Committee in our state Senate. And Rhodes, since Trump came back into office, has held a few of these info briefings with important experts on the rule of law, and this one had a climate focus. And it was looking at climate impacts and how our ability to respond to those impacts has changed under the Trump administration. And something that brought those climate impacts to top of mind was the recent devastation from Hurricane Melissa across the Caribbean, which was a Category 5 storm and one of the most intense Atlantic storms on record. And so in that meeting on Monday, Senator Rhodes asked Leah Laramie, who's with the State Climate Commission, about the likelihood of such a storm hitting Hawaii. And she said modeling shows that Hawaii is at higher risk for a Category 4, maybe even Category 5 storms, and climate change is making the storms that we see in the Pacific more intense. And if anything, the modeling that we developed to predict climate impacts 20 years ago has underestimated the risk.
Every time we do additional analysis and look at what the impacts have been, we've seen hotter temperatures, drier rainfall, and more intense frequency in storms. It changes year to year. You know, sometimes we'll have wetter years, sometimes we'll have drier years. These extreme weather events, we can skip a few years and it seems like, okay, it's not going to be so bad. But, you know, we've seen the intensity just increase. And, you know, these, though they might hit a certain part of the islands, I think we're going to continue to see pretty devastating impacts.
And I think we're still in hurricane season, right?
Yes, yeah, for about a month. So that's definitely still top of mind. And Laramie expressed like clear cause for concern, but also in a lot of detail how federal support for addressing climate change has just kind of sputtered in the last year.
So what are some of the programs that have been cut or were suspended?
So in that meeting, they talked about programs like Solar for All, which, for instance, is an Environmental Protection Agency program that was supposed to give over $60 million to Hawaii to develop community solar. That's been cut. Another program from the USDA called the Climate Smart Commodities Initiative that was more than $40 million to support climate mitigation practices in agriculture. There have been efforts to dismantle the AmeriCorps VISTA program. Many of their volunteers work on climate programs. And then, of course, tax credits cut for electric vehicles, for heat pumps, and then impending deadlines for rooftop solar and utility-scale solar, and a lot of elimination for positions at federal agencies, particularly NOAA, which is of top of mind as we are thinking about hurricane season. And then in some instances, it isn't that the funding has been cut per se, it's just been kind of allowed to let die. And that was the instance that was true of the Pacific Islands Climate Adaptation Science Center, which was this huge kind of nexus that supported a lot of climate work throughout Hawaii. they applied for a re-up to their federal funding in February. They were looking for a $10 million award that would have kept them afloat for another 5 years. And they waited for months for that funding to materialize, and it just didn't. So they had to shutter on October 1st, which affected the salaries of a number of staff and graduate students. And at some point, the Department of Interior, who gives them their funding, could renew the process, but their executive director, Darren Lerner, said it wouldn't be like flipping a switch back on.
It will be challenging as we create this gap and as we've lost certain capacities in faculty and staff that have necessarily had to move to other opportunities. So now, instead of having a smooth transition where people are on board and the funding then comes in that was supposed to begin October 1 as the last cycle ends September 30, should the Department of Interior and USGS honor the process of the rebid for which we submitted a proposal in response to a notice of federal funding opportunity and move that forward, that will, of course, necessarily take time. Even if they started that process tomorrow, it will take months to then result in funding being available to us here on our campuses. And then instead of the smooth transition, we will need to first start by hiring individuals with the kinds of expertise that are necessary to fill the positions to run the daily business of the CASC.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know Governor Green indicated he was planning to meet with the Interior Secretary at a gathering this month. We'll see what comes out of that.
Right. And so we've so far talked about impacts to the Department of Interior, USDA, the Environmental Protection Agency, NOAA. All of those are having impacts to their climate programs that are trickling down to Hawaii. And any sort of progress, right, is kind of out of the question. Like a renewable for the climate center is out of the question during the current shutdown. And so the shutdown has brought all these new disruptions to organizations that have had to pause certain activities. Like just last week, Catherine, you and I were talking about how sampling for rapid ohia death is on pause. Or there are other organizations that are using different sources of funds, either private or state funds, to stay afloat while the government is closed.
And what else is the state doing to try and respond to this loss of funds?
So one area where we've seen the state be really active is out of the state attorney general's office. Leah Laramie, in her presentation, said they've undertaken over 40 legal actions related to climate and environment since January, and they have been successful in some cases. So one win was they, along with more than 20 other states, sued over the closure of the AmeriCorps VISTA program. And a judge ruled in their favor, and the Trump administration actually released funds to that program in August. And that was especially important to the Climate Commission itself, which Leah Laramie works on, since it has several VISTA volunteers. They're trying to get Solar for All funds back. They're involved in a lawsuit because those funds are obligated. And then one of the highest profile things that they've been involved in is a state lawsuit against legacy oil companies, which alleges that those companies misled the public about the role fossil fuels play in climate change. Hmm. Honolulu and Maui County have similar cases. What was unique about this one is, in an unprecedented move, the Trump administration actually filed a lawsuit against the state of Hawaii the day before the AG filed their case, trying to stop Hawaii from seeking punitive damages. And so the defendants in Hawaii's lawsuit, those oil companies, they pointed to that case and asked a judge for a stay to see if any action is taken at the federal level. So that a judge granted that stay, and our case is actually on ice for 180 days until the end of January. So
yeah.
That's what the first earliest we would see progress there.
Well, we'll see how this plays out. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing about funding for climate initiatives here in Hawaii from HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Live from the Atherton presents Celebrate 808. Join us this Saturday, November 8th, for The Listening Room, a speakeasy-style night of deep cuts and sonic gems from HPR's Bridging the Gap music hosts. Step inside HPR studio after hours and let the music do the talking. Tickets and details at hawaiipublicradio.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a rare Kauai songbird, a thrush called the puaiohi.
The puaiohi is a small thrush that's found only on Kauai. With a population size of only about 500 individuals, they're not only critically endangered, but they're also one of the rarest birds in the world. They're a bit drab, with grayish-brown plumage, a white eye ring, and pink feet, but the juveniles have a striking scalloped pattern of feathers on their breast. In the 1990s, the puaiohi was thought to be on the brink of extinction, so biologists from state and federal agencies, along with the San Diego Zoo, started a captive breeding program to act as an insurance policy against extinction, and to add wild birds to the population. By 2012, over 200 puaiohi had been raised in captivity and released back to the wild, though many of these did not survive through their first year. The current population can be found primarily within a small patch of rainforest, only about 2 miles by 3 miles wide, on the Alakai Plateau on the top of the island of Kauai. Within that area, they're found mainly along the banks of the many streams where they nest in steep ledges and cliffs. Like other rare and cryptic birds, the best way to find one is not by sight, but by sound. Similar to other thrushes, puaiohi love to consume insects and all kinds of native fruits from the forest. One recent study showed that they're better than any other bird species on Kauai at dispersing fruits from native plants. Unlike many other native Hawaiian birds, disease may not be the major reason why they're so rare, as puaiohi seem to have a natural resistance to mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. Instead, rat predation on females sitting on the nest is likely the primary reason their numbers remain so low. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
A podcast created by a group of students at Kalaheo High School has been named one of the best student podcasts in the country. NPR holds an annual student podcast challenge, and out of a pool of nearly 2,000 submissions, the show Waves in Wisdom placed in the top 10. The show explores the cost of living in Hawaii and how the people who live here make ends meet. Take a listen.
Aloha, this is Waves in Wisdom, a student voice podcast run by Kalaheo High School. I'm Emma.
And I'm Jet.
On today's episode, Worth the Cost, we're taking a look at what draws people to live in Hawaii.
Although Hawaii has the seventh highest median income in the U.S., it is not the paradise it's perpetuated. According to the World Population Review, Hawaii is ranked number one in highest costs of living. This includes transportation, groceries, housing, and healthcare. The cost of living index for our island is 189.6, which is nearly double the national average. Most notably, Emma, the cost of housing in Hawaii is 3 times more expensive than the national average.
Jet, why do people love this island so much, and what draws them to stay, despite the cost? Here with us are Kumu Kanoi, who has lived in Hawaii her whole life, and Miss Vela, who is moving away.
They are both teachers at Kalaheo and are going to tell us what makes Hawaii worth the cost.
I think because I'm Native Hawaiian, I think that I have I feel like this intrinsic tying to the land. I actually feel that. I know people talk about it and like it's like, oh, is that like a real thing that like they actually believe in? And I would say yes. I feel like my connection to the place I live, and because I'm Hawaiian, that's really special.
Three of the students on the podcast team came by our studios to talk with the Conversations G.W. Gibson. They are Jenna Nguyen, Emmy Nishimura, and Emma Wittig. They were joined by their teacher, Kathy Shigemura.
Emma, I'll start with you since you were one of the voices for the podcast. Waves and Wisdom, tell us where this idea started.
So we had our group of six people and we all sat down and we started shooting ideas. And the name itself, Waves of Wisdom, is kind of a play on words because waves represent us and we live in Kailua, so our closeness to the ocean, closeness and connection to the land, as well as waves as in sound waves, like a podcast. And then our wisdom part would be like we're trying to share our wisdom, what we think about the topic that we spoke about.
And Emmy, tell us more about that topic. Tell us what the focus of this podcast is that you were editing.
The title of our podcast in part was Worth the Cost. So we were sort of discussing, you know, what makes Hawaii worth living. So we wanted to sort of tackle why people would sacrifice. Like, it's extremely financially stressful or straining to live in Hawaii because of the high cost of living. And we wanted to sort of delve deeper into the more cultural aspects that make Hawaii so special to the people who do live here, especially to the locals, and also to the people who come from the mainland but find a home here.
Staying with you, Emmy, were there personal experiences that you all brought as students in terms of observations you've made in your own community, in your own families, in terms of that cost of living and how it informed you approach this?
I mean, Kalaheo as a whole, it's a very diverse school, so we have a lot of military, so Jenna's military. I was born and raised here. Emma,
I moved here when I was like two.
So we sort of mainly, primarily for the beginning, the foundational idea, we sort of drew upon what we've seen with our own eyes from the news, from talking to like our friends and our family and our family's friends, to what we've seen like in our classmates as well.
Drawing on all of your networks and all of those experiences that are around you, right? Jenna, tell me some of the things you all learned while working on this podcast. What were some of the responses that you heard from people in terms of the cost of living issues that they face?
Well, in our podcast, we interviewed three different teachers. And as a military kid from a military family, I think I resonate with this story from one of our teachers, Ms. Koopman, the most, since she is the one that talked about her experience coming from a military family stationed in Hawaii and just learning that she loved it here so much that she was willing to stay here for the rest of her life, basically, and just how she explained why she chose here in Hawaii over living in the mainland or international.
And you had a very special role with the podcast as well in terms of some design work you did. Tell us about that work.
Yes. So I was asked by Ms. Shigemura to create a little podcast cover for us. And to be honest, I didn't really know where to go from there. So as a designer would, I searched up online and I looked up podcast ideas. What should I put on my podcast cover for everyone? Because we are all together on this as a team and I wanted to reflect that. One of the fun things that I did on this project was actually make a little logo for all of us. It says Waves of Wisdom on it, and I did a little play on a wave, that like a picture of a wave, and I made it look like, I think it was like a hat as a wizard wisdom. I tried to play on that, and it came out really nice. And then I also added these hibiscus flowers to represent Hawaii, and I made the flowers stand out in color while everything else is black and white, just to really emphasize how much Hawaii means to all of us, how colorful it is, how significant it is, and how special it is to all of us.
And Ms. Shigemura, your name was invoked, so we should bring you into the conversation here. Tell us about the opportunity that the school provides for these students to do this type of work. How long has Kalaheo been providing this type of opportunity, and how many kids are involved?
We have a media program that started, I think, back in 1989 or 1992, a while back from, It's a learning center that was a special grant that we get special funding separate from regular school funding. And currently we have about 150 kids in our program. And then we have opportunities to enter different contests. And when I saw this podcast challenge, I thought, oh, this would be a good way to bond as a team.
And how long have you been involved with the media program at the school?
Since 2002.
Since 2002.
Yeah.
So 2002, I think we're going back to sort of Internet 1.0 at that point. Probably a lot more people still getting newspapers delivered to their...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about a couple of decades here. What kind of changes have you seen in that expanse of time in terms of student interest in media? Has it diminished, increased, shifted to different formats of dissemination?
I think our kids at Kalahale are always interested in media and storytelling. I think just the technology has changed, right? Like, I remember working with tape, and now it's an SD card. And I think they recorded this podcast just on their phone.
Is that true? Emma, can you give us some details on how you guys approach this, technically speaking?
So the recording process for me and my co-anchor, Jet, we wanted to use nice, like, professional-ish materials, but unfortunately, because we only had 5 days, we challenged ourselves to complete it in only 5 days. So we ended up using our phones in a small room that had a little bit of nothing in there. And we were reading our script from a Google Doc and just going. And that's how we did it.
But I think that speaks to the accessibility of doing this, right? If technology has come along and become more accessible and made it more possible to do projects like this.
For sure.
So with that in mind, do you have other projects in mind? Do you have other topics that you want to go to?
Well, this was the first podcast that I've ever done. So I want to improve my skills, especially as an anchor, like reading out loud, something I'm working on.
Jenna, media is changing so dramatically now, right?
Yes.
And it has been for so many years. And all of you are growing up in this environment with this rapid change. And I wonder, maybe even if you could just speak a little bit about where you get your own news, where you get your own storytelling, and where you see the work you're doing fitting into that landscape.
To be honest, before we even participated in the NPR podcast challenge, I was someone who did not get my news at all. I think the last time I ever watched the news on TV was probably when I was in like third grade. And that was with my family at home. And after making our podcast submission for NPR, I started to really like think how much time people really put into podcasts, how much time they put into like our news that we get. And I think from that point on, earlier this year when we submitted it, whenever I've been in the car, I just feel like turning on the radio. I want to see what other people are talking about and just really appreciating how much they've worked on their own little projects to share their news with us.
It's opened your eyes to how much work goes into creating. I love the notion of how it sort of opened you up as a listener in a lot of ways. Ms. Shigemura, I wonder if while working on projects like this with students, if there are discussions you have about media literacy, right? Or fact checking. This is a big concern in the age of misinformation and disinformation. Is that a part of the programming as you see it?
When they say something, I always tell them, like, back it up with a statistic so that they know that they have to get some resources in there, credible resources.
Right? Going beyond the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, yeah.
Emma, you talked about wanting to hone your skills as a host. Is this something that you see yourself doing beyond high school?
For sure. So I'm actually we have a news team. We're all part of it at our school, and I'm one of two hosts. I joined last year as a freshman, and I took on a minor role as the College and Career Center announcer. I've been doing news and news-related programs since I was in sixth grade. In sixth grade, I joined my news program in Carnaulu Elementary School with Miss Angie, and it was an eye-opening, amazing experience, and I loved it so much that I did it in middle school with Miss Ronfo at KIS, and it was, again, super fun. And I started going on field trips to Kalahale, and I'm seeing Jenna and Emmy doing their thing, making media, making news. And I was like, that is so cool. So I joined up, and right now I'm a head anchor, and I'm trying to get better, and I'm very much interested in going into broadcast journalism maybe in my future.
What motivates this interest in media for you?
I think it's really important to share stuff with the world because That's like what brings people together. It's what connects us. Even if it's just saying the lunch today is fish sticks or whatever, just like it connects us. It builds relationships. People go out there and be like, hey, you're on the news. I'm like, yes, I am. Thanks for watching. I appreciate it. Yeah.
It's a good way. Yeah, it's a good way to connect to the people you're in communities with, multiple communities, right?
For sure.
Emmy, I'm curious to know what was maybe one of the more challenging parts of this process.
As Emma mentioned before, we set ourselves like a 5-day deadline. Time was a challenge. I guess personally, like as the editor, like I was sort of the last step or stage in the process. And so for me, like the biggest stressor was our school actually had AP exams that same week that the podcast was due. And so it was kind of stressful to be managing a podcast and also studying for this college exam. That was definitely a big stressor for when I was trying to complete the final edit of the podcast.
Wow. Yeah. Editing a podcast and AP exams. Might as well throw in an SAT at that point. That's a lot going on. Is this something that you see yourself continuing in, doing this kind of work in the future?
Media is definitely one of my passions that I do want to continue throughout my life. I don't think it's a career for me, but I do think I don't want to lose that love for it. And so I really hope to like continue doing it maybe as volunteer work or something.
So that's a great point you make about not knowing whether or not it'll be a career or not. Sometimes it's harder to hold on to that passion when it becomes about making a buck,
yes,
right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. That's.
Jenna, how about you? I wonder, you know, what would you say was one of the more rewarding parts of this process?
So I think this was like a topic that we kind of barely touched upon earlier, but we did mention how NPR in the challenge rules, one of the things that they list is that they don't necessarily account for how good the quality of your podcast is. And to be honest, when I was looking at those rules, I kind of didn't believe it. Because, you know, when you're listening to a podcast, you would rather prefer the one that sounds nice and polished compared to the one that has like little audio stuff happening in the background and kind of blurry and you can hear all the static. But since we made this podcast, Waves of Wisdom, and we recorded it on our phones, and we were able to make it to the top 10. I think, even though that is something where we got recognized as an NPR, I think that is really, really, really the highlight of what I, like my participation in this project. That was the reward I felt the most working as a team with you guys.
That was Jenna Nguyen, Emmy Nishimura, Emma Wittig from Kalaheo High School, along with their teacher, Kathy Shigemura. They spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson. We will have a link to their podcast, Waves in Wisdom, on our website later today. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to get the long view and give you a front row seat of a scene playing out in front of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Portland. Have you been affected by the immigration crackdown in any way? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.